Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Ghibliotheque, the podcast that raises the curtain on the stage production of My Neighbour Totoro. I'm Michael Leader. Just me this week. We're currently in book tour mode, and at the moment Jake is in transit between Sussex and London following our screening of Millennium Actress in Lewes last night. So here I am to tee up what should be, fingers crossed, the first of a few interviews with the very talented people behind the stage production of My Neighbour Totoro that's currently on at the Barbican Centre in London. Today, Jake and I are talking to Basil Twist, who is behind the puppet creations we see in the show. Now, at the time that we were recording this chat, we hadn't seen the production, and they're still keeping a lot of the surprises of the production under wraps, so I'd say this chat is spoiler-free. But of course, if you've already booked your tickets and you want to go and see Totoro as unspoiled as possible, we won't judge you if you save this chat for later. Let's have some background for Basil before we dive in. Basil Twist is a third-generation puppeteer, originally from San Francisco. Since moving to New York over 23 years ago, he has garnered an international reputation as an audacious designer, director, and performer. Basil creates iconic, visionary puppetry worlds with a remarkable range of style and scope, appearing in intimate nightclubs to large orchestra halls. He is a sought-after collaborator for theatre, ballet, opera, dance, and film. His utterly unique approaches have been recognised with multiple awards and fellowships, critical acclaim, and have furthered contemporary artistry and the technical craft of puppetry. Basil is known for revitalising puppetry as a serious and sophisticated art form through his imaginative experiments with materials, techniques, and uses in both narrative and abstract works. His shows range from productions of classic stories to abstract visualizations of orchestral music, and they're informed by puppetry traditions from around the world. Now, that's enough from me. Let's hear from Basil Twist.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Basil, thank you so much for joining us today. So for context, we haven't yet seen the production, but when this episode goes out, people around, you know, people will have seen it. It would have been unveiled to the world. We can't wait to see what you've got in store for us. But I suppose for this conversation, we're talking about the process of designing and creating the puppets we're going to see. But to start with, I'd like to ask, what was your relationship with Studio Ghibli before this? Were they on your radar?
Of course they were. I've sort of fallen out more down the rabbit hole. I of course knew Spirited Away and knew Totoro and Princess Mononoke, but didn't know them as well. Like, mm-hmm. Now I've watched Totoro, of course, a million times. So I was aware of them as this, you know, spectacular entity in Japan and creative genius. But I didn't have a connection other than I'm a total Japanophile. So I love Japan. I love all things Japanese. I love Japanese puppetry. I've spent time in Japan. And so I thought, yeah, that's cool. But I hadn't done the deep dive particularly on Totoro until I got involved in this project.
Oh, so what's the history with Japan for you then? Where did that start? Was that something from when you were young or later in life?
As a puppeteer, most, I would say, generally, puppeteers around the world have immense reverence for the puppetry of Japan, particularly the Bunraku tradition, which is a style of puppetry that's kind of developed in tandem with the Kabuki. It's one of the great theatrical traditions of Japan, along with Kabuki and No. So Bunraku is like the most highly elevated and sophisticated and exquisite form of puppetry in the world, hands down. And it's a noble tradition. And so we all, as puppeteers, who generally feel kind of marginalized as artists, kind of bow down to the immense heft of that tradition that exists in the Bunraku, which is a specific theater in Japan. It's a specific troupe, and it has influenced puppetry around the world. The notable characteristics of Bunraku is that there are three puppeteers per puppet and that the puppeteers are visible. So like now we've all seen that in War Horse and in The Lion King, having puppeteers be visible in particular, and of course having multiple puppeteers working together on a character. But the Japanese were doing that hundreds of years ago. So, and they still maintain that craft and that sort of apprenticeship and training, which is decades long to become a master puppeteer. So that's the initial kind of real deep connection with Japan, that respect for that puppetry tradition. And then I studied other puppetry traditions there and went to Japan and created a show that actually I brought here to the Barbican in the smaller theater in the pit with the London International Mime Festival in 2015, I think. It was called Dogu Gayashi, and it's a homage to a certain Japanese puppetry technique that involves sliding screen doors. So it's a whole show of sliding screen doors. And I went to Japan to study that, and I just loved being there and love. I'm just desperate to go back whenever I can. I've been a couple times and I want to go again. So yeah, I love Japan and it's amazing.
You're speaking the language of our listeners there, I'm sure. And so from a more cinephile point of view, you said it was just a handful of Ghibli films that you knew prior going into this. Getting up to this point in your career and the early stages of your career when you're discovering who you are as an artist, what would you say are the key films, key texts that were shaping your voice?
You mean not just the Ghibli films, but other films?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, this speaker will keep coming on. I don't know how to turn it off.
Sorry.
I'm also a Disney head. I mean, I was very influenced by Disney as a kid. So I loved animation. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be an animator. Animation, you know, is actually the same spirit. Film animation and live puppetry animation is the same. It's kind of the same essential, phenomenon where you're bringing something to life, and that we believe in something because we suggest something. My training as a puppeteer, I was trained in France. So I grew up in California. I was trained in France in a school that was a response to the Eastern European puppetry training traditions, which frequently combined live puppetry and stop motion animation. They kind of were on a similar track. They existed within the same schools. So I don't know, animation already was something that inspired me. And as a kid, I wanted to be an animator. I kind of flip-flopped between wanting to be an animator and a puppeteer. And I was, as an American, I loved Disney and I loved the Muppets. Those were my two things. They just, that was where I lived and loved things as a kid. So there you go. From an animation point of view, I mean, it's a very simple thing. It was a Disney. I loved Disney. And then I later fell into the Muppets and became obsessed with puppetry. Although puppetry is already in my family. My mother was a puppeteer when I was a kid, and my grandfather was a musician. He was a big band leader in the 30s and 40s, but he used puppets as part of his act. So I have a kind of a puppetry's in my blood somehow. So it makes sense that I've ended up where I am.
Mm. And so to get specific with the Totoro project for a second, so how do you start with a gig like this? What's the first step? And did you have any sort of personal aims or principles that you came to this project with that you wanted to achieve?
Let's see. I mean, I was working with the creative team of Fela McDermott, the director, and Tom Pye, the production designer. So we were working on an opera together. We were doing a production of Aida, and that started at the English National Opera. I was working on that production in terms of, I was animating silk. So I'm also I use silk. I approach silk as a medium. I approach it as a puppeteer, bringing it to life. So I was the silk choreographer on that show, as I have done on a few other UK shows actually. And they had been invited to do Totoro, and since I was part of their team, it was kind of obvious they needed somebody like me to help realize the creatures. So, and the title character, of course. So, I guess my first, thing was to sit down with them and imagine, watch the film as the reference, understand what we wanted to convey in the film. How do you translate a film, an animated film, to a live stage experience? And the film is actually very, when you study it, it's very, point of view, like it's very subjective from the child's point of view, like it's from May, the younger, the daughter's point of view first, and then it moves to Satsuki's point of view. And it's so it's really from their point of view, which is in the film. If you look at the film, Totoro himself actually kind of changes shape and size and scale depending on how close she is to him, what her experiences is of him. So it's really trying to recreate that sense of the experience of him as experienced by a child, and how you do that on stage, and how you create a large creature without having it be like a guy walking around in a suit, but actually really having it be as thrilling and majestic as it should be when you discover a giant forest spirit. And I don't know, to play around with some concepts around that, using some of the stuff I'd done before. As I said, I used fabric and a lot. So it was like, that was a natural place for me to start and to work with my, you know, co-collaborators to see, is this right? Is this what you're thinking? And then also to represent that to our Japanese partners, who of course were most concerned about how the characters are going to be represented. And I just, you know, you just have to start somewhere making a prototype. I always start with prototypes with really humble materials to give the idea, to give a sense of scale and the basic functionality of things. So you make stuff out of cardboard and fabric and tape and people can kind of squint and say, oh yeah, that's the right idea. And that was all, of course, complicated by almost, you know, we started this process in January 2020. So we were meant to have I was about to come to the UK to do our first puppetry workshop, and then the pandemic hit and we were all shut down. But we continued Zooming and talking, and our Japanese partners. I actually, like a lot of people during the pandemic, I'm mostly based in New York, but I, like a lot of people, I moved back in with my parents in San Francisco, which is where I grew up. So I spent a year in San Francisco, and I was working, you know, exactly between the UK and Japan. So we were 8 hours in either direction in terms of time zones. Of course, I was always getting the short end of the stick, and I was the guy in the middle of the night on the Zoom calls. But they really wanted to, the Japanese wanted to see how are we going to do these characters? How are they going to be represented? So I had to start to make mock-ups within these limited circumstances of really full lockdown. But I did it in California, in the backyard at my parents' house, and using my siblings and their kids as my puppeteers to represent that. And that's a really fun footage that I made and sent, you know, to the Japanese to get their approval. And eventually we got to a place where we wanted to, you know, gather in the UK to work. I needed to quarantine for 2 weeks to do that. And the miracle also was that the stage of the Barbican, as there was no programming in the Barbican, no audiences were gathering, but the stage was empty. So we actually were able to work on stage and have a developmental workshop on stage. And I think there's some footage of that and some promotional material where we're all wearing masks and we're trying to work socially distanced and puppeteering. And, you know, this idea of like, puppeteering multiple puppeteers together on one thing and that being, you know, not exactly COVID safe was super challenging. But what was amazing was I used those kind of really simple things that I had made in California and we sent them here. And then we actually were working on stage at the Barbican. So working not only rehearsing, but also building, we kind of turned the stage into a workshop. So that we kept building again in really humble materials, kind of sheets of plastic and fabric and cardboard, just to get the shape of things. Like, what is the Catbus going to be like? What is Totoro? How does Totoro, when he's at the bus stop and he jumps in the air, how do you do that? How are we going to do that? And how does that feel in this space? And that was an immense privilege, actually, to be able to do that with the, if it weren't for the pandemic, I would not have been able, I'm sure, to work in my parents' backyard to develop this with my family and to work on stage at the Barbican in the actual venue where the show is being created for, to try out some of the ideas in a really experimental way. That was seriously, you know, there are silver linings all over this experience of the past years, and those were two of them in this process. And since the process is so tied, chronologically with the pandemic, it's really extraordinary to be getting to, you know, the premiere.
Yeah, it must be so special and meaningful when you finally get there, this chunk of your life finally realized. I'm interested, you talk about these humble materials and humble sort of crafting practices. We've just done a miniseries on stop motion animation, and in the last 30, as you said, you go back to the mid-20th century, there is some crossover there in the practice. But in the last 30 years of mainstream American stop motion, the whole process has been revolutionized by 3D printing and other processes that get further and further away from the handcraftedness. But is that handcraftedness still something that you're very interested in?
Oh my God, yes, totally. That's what it's about for me. Mm. Absolutely. I mean, there's a couple things that have been 3D printed. It's nice. That's an amazing tool. But the craft of creating puppets and bringing them to life is very, very, very human and very, very analog and very old world. And I think it's part of why people respond to it so strongly, because we're kind of even more and more thirsty for that. And puppetry speaks to a very simple magic that's very profound, and it's innate in human beings pre-technology. And so yes, absolutely, we are we are very very craft hands oriented human analog solutions. That's the way that we go. That's part of why I work in live theater and not film. I need that immediacy of that feeling of bringing something to life and experiencing it. That's
really interesting. You mentioned about not working in film, because obviously this is a film adaptation, and thinking of you've got your two sides that you're working in between your Japanese partners and your stage directors in the UK. Can you talk about the process of not just trying to adapt something from a film onto stage, but making it its own unique thing as well? Because I'm sure you're torn in lots of directions as to how similar something needs to be, how different it needs to be, how abstracted it needs to be to deliver both something that is representative of the thing that is so beloved, but also its own original version as well.
It's a multi-layered thing, because I use the film, of course, as the original inspiration. So I'm speaking to you on an iPad. I have the film on my iPad. I look at it all the time to see how is the cat bus's head in relationship to its front legs. What did Ghibli decide to do there? So I use that as my reference. How far apart are Totoro's ears in this scene? So I use the film as my reference, but then eventually you get to a place where you hopefully create some magnificent puppets. And part of what you're doing too, as I was saying, is you're trying to recreate point of view in a film. So an experience that a child would have, and how do you recreate that for an audience? How do you have the audience, if you can't keep changing camera angle, if you're looking from a fixed point, how do you represent the essentials of this is now May's moment? This is how the 4-year-old sister May, how is she experiencing this? How do you create that for the whole audience to be with her? And you know, that has to do in choices of materials and scale and what do you show and what do you not show? Because there's always a point at which people will fill in the gaps too. That's part of what puppetry does, is that you're referencing an idea. A great example is Warhorse. Warhorse, the incredible puppets of Warhorse, they were beautifully executed. The movement was great, but they weren't real horses. They were the idea of a horse. And the idea of a horse is more powerful than a real horse, actually. It's stronger for human beings, what our idea is. So the idea of Totoro, especially for fans, is so strong, if you, even if you approach it, if you get close to it, people fill in a lot of gaps. People fill in, they imagine into it. It's part of the collaboration with the audience. And it's particularly true for something that exists already that people know and love. There's a danger also that people know and love it so much that they're like, hey, those ears are too far apart, or they're too close together, not doing the right thing. But there's also the thing that people have in their mind that they can project into it. So if you get close, if you suggest Totoro, the suggestion of Totoro enough is to bring the spirit of Totoro into the entire experience of the audience. That's the nature of puppetry. It always is that people, there's a collaborative element with the audience where people are basically filling in the gaps. They're not just suspending their disbelief. They're believing in something. And they're believing in an informed way if it's a character that they know and love already.
I find it interesting, Basil, you mentioned the idea of Totoro there in the minds of the audience coming to the production after seeing the film. Of course, there is also the idea of Totoro in the eyes of your Japanese collaborators. So what was that collaboration like? What sort of feedback were you getting from them? What concerns did they have about the representation of this character in this form?
I don't know. It's funny. I mean, I was pleased that my first volley to them was well received. So our primary collaborator is Joe Hisaishi. So the composer. So he's one of the co-producers, and he's our main connection with Ghibli. And there's a Japanese way of a kind of hierarchy of how you go through people eventually to get to Joe. So you have to sort of deal with his team, who then gets to him. I mean, it's not just Japanese, it's everywhere, but it's particularly Japanese. So it takes a while. But when we got to Joe, he was pleased with the initial offering. I think that they had experience before that they were concerned about. One is they were worried that it not look like some guy in a suit that would be like at an amusement park. I think they were also concerned there has been attempts at doing Ghibli productions and they have used a lot of video. So like a stage show that uses a lot of video, it feels like it's not a film, but it's not a stage product. It's kind of like, so they really didn't want that. So they actually, I think they were very pleased with what I first presented. And there's, as happens with puppetry, you kind of need to create different puppets for different applications sometimes. So there's sort of multiple suggestions of how the characters are represented. And I don't know, they were really positive and responsive. I think they maybe had low expectations because they thought, they just didn't want a bad video thing or a guy walking around in a suit, and it wasn't that. And then, as you get into it, of course, there's a little bit, they're like, oh, maybe the eyes are too far apart or something, they have those kind of things. Where at some point, that's really valuable feedback. And then there's a place at which we're doing this here in our way, and they're movies we're inspired by, and we're doing it the way that we, in our medium, in live theater and in a Western trained puppetry sense, what can we bring to it, to this idea? So in general, it's been, fabulous. They've been positive and responsive and also, respectfully, and I think it was that first kind of volley that happened, as I said, when I was in California working, in my parents' backyard, that they were like, oh, cool, this is great. This is going in the right direction. This is interesting. This is fresh. This is cool. And then they've let us do our, when we would do these workshops that we had at the Barbican, they would zoom in. So they're part of the process. and they came. Some came, not Joe Hisashi, but some of the team came. His team came to our rehearsal period in Stratford and saw us working. So I think everything's been pretty cool. I mean, it's a big project and it's still, you know, challenging, but but I know we're on the right path. Been on it for a while.
This is the hard part for asking a question like this when we haven't seen the production yet. But is there a moment in the production that was either particularly challenging or that you're now particularly proud of realizing? As also, you are currently rehearsing, of course. So there's an element there of casting ahead a couple of weeks. But already in the design and the creation of the puppets, is there a particular one that you're proud of?
God, I don't know. I try and be proud of all of them, and they all still have their kinks to work out. But I feel pretty great about the reveal of Totoro when we meet him the first time. So when May encounters him sleeping and is on his belly, I think it's pretty cool.
Because I suppose that is the moment, isn't it? That
yeah,
is almost makes or breaks the magic in a way. That needs to be the part that sells it.
Yeah, I mean the other one is at the bus stop when he's waiting and he has his umbrella. He jumps in the air. That's also there's a thing where you do it. You originally do it and you do it in humble materials, and then you have to actually realize it and how it changes along the way and how you have to accommodate those changes of different materials that might be heavier or more robust, but then they lose something else. So how do you maintain that? How do you stay with the freshness of the original idea and keep those things in both of those ideas? Those, you know, Totoro actually he's not in the show a lot. They're very brief appearances. It's the same in the film. You know, you almost get through half the film and he hasn't appeared yet. So, and those scenes are not, they're essentially wordless too, you know, so as you they just, and he also doesn't do a lot, like he's sleeping a lot or he's just standing there, you know, so how to make those things really radiate a lot of energy, of character, of soul, with, you know, with just a big furry guy who's just standing at a bus stop. But they're pretty cool. It was, of course, for me also as a puppeteer, I referred to as the, you know, young kid in the States, I was obsessed with the Muppets. So I've been really fortunate to work with the Jim Henson Company a couple times, and this was a great opportunity to work with them again, and everybody, especially the Japanese, were really excited to bring those partners in. And it was great for me also, of course, because of the international collaboration, but during an international pandemic, to be able to work in the States and to be able to work with a company with a legacy that's respected around the world. And they do great work. It's beautiful. So it's wonderful to have that, that, you know, that soulfulness within the puppets that comes from working with the Jim Henson Company.
And through that process of watching the film 1,000 times and almost reverse engineering the characters to work in this more abstracted live atmosphere, do you have any insights into why Totoro has been such a magical, enduring character for successive generations?
You know, it's I'll say that in particular working I watched the film with my with children, so with my sister's children. I don't have kids, but my siblings do. So during the pandemic I watched Totoro with my sister's two daughters, and they're a little bit older. They were I guess 7 and 9, so they were slightly older than the characters on stage, or at least older than May, but they were young girls, and they went nuts about Totoro. I was like kind of shocked at how they wanted to watch it again and again and again. It actually really struck me. I was sort of confused by it. And I think it's because it really is, I saw more and more how much it is from a child's point of view, that the drama that there is, which there's very, actually, you know, it's said frequently about Totoro, not much happens in it, but there's so much that happens in their, in May's experience of her mother and her, is the mother going to be okay and bring her the corn and she get lost and all this stuff is like, it's so epic. So it's from the point of view of a child, of a little girl, that is so successfully captured in the film that it really resonates for a kid. I guess I saw that especially when I watched it with kids. Because as an adult, I watched it and I go, well, that's a strange movie. It's sort of strange. It's got, it's kind of wistful and slow. It's kind of odd. And there's all these moments where there's just a toad crossing the road in the rain. And those are things that you cannot replicate on stage. You can't replicate that sense of time too. There's also a different, having engaged with Japanese art forms enough, I know that already there's a different sense of time that's represented on stage that a Western audience probably won't accept. But how to bring that kind of soulfulness in and that sense of presence, I think Phelim, our director, is the right person for that. Mm. And he's really created a really extraordinary cohesion in the ensemble here that's ready for that, you know, bringing all of that soulfulness is the word that keeps coming up. It's just that's within every scene. If it's in a puppet, if it's in just the stillness of a scene, if it's in just the tiny emotions that become epic for a child, he's really great at that. And yeah, I don't know if I'm answering your question or just babbling, but.
That's the perfect answer to the question. I know you need to make tracks, but we do have one final question that we ask all our guests. And Jake, I'll let you ask it this time.
Yeah, well, so over the course of the podcast, we've looked at all of Studio Ghibli's films. We ran out of those. And then we watched all of Satoshi Kon's films. And then we've done Cartoon Saloon and Henry Selick and Laika and all of these filmmakers. And we're always looking for new directions to go in, whether that's in live action, animation, stop motion, 2D, 3D, whatever it might be. So where do you think, as a podcast, we could look to next? Who's got an interesting story to tell? Whose films or series should we be looking at?
In animation specifically, or?
Whatever, it could be anything.
I suppose the question is, would you think that Jim Henson's TV and feature film work would be worth exploring in this way?
I think that that was my natural thing, is that Jim Henson's work, I mean, particularly off the charts, is The Dark Crystal. Dark Crystal was so, it was so radical that people couldn't even really receive it, because it came out of, also it came out of, you know, he was making the most, it was the most popular television show in the world, The Muppet Show, and he stopped doing that so he could make this fantasy film that existed pre-computer digital arts. It's all completely analog, and there's not a single human appears in it. That film is so seminal to Jim Henson's legacy and the kind of the legacy of creatures in film and creating worlds. The recent reboot that happened on Netflix, the success of that. And I don't think it was as successful. It obviously did not, there was response was not enough for them to repeat to do their season, but that they recreated that universe, to create an entire universe and to do it essentially with non-digital means is so I have so much respect for it, for the labor and the love and the passion that it takes to do that. That's Yeah, I'm so proud to be working with the Creature Shop, which created the Totoro creatures, was born of the Dark Crystal. That was how that initiative started, was creating, you know, creatures for films, semi-realistic creatures, not just the stylized characters of the Muppet Show, but things that were more had more realism to them, even though they were fantasy. The Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, and the Storyteller, all those late things of Jim Henson's are really extraordinary. I mean, I'm proud to be connected with the Creature Shop that was born from those.
Perfect. I would love to go and do a Jim Henson series. That'd be so much fun.
No, you should.
Well, Basil, thank you so much for speaking with us. We can't wait to see the production, but congratulations for all your work so far.
Thank you. Thanks
so much, Basil.
Thank you to Basil Twist for joining us today to give us such insight into the process behind the My Neighbor Totoro stage production. What a great chat that was, talking about that crossover between stop motion, puppetry, film and theatre. I really think that's music to our ears, considering the miniseries that we've had throughout this year. Thanks to Bethany at the Royal Shakespeare Company for helping us set up this interview. Now, we hope to be back later with more insight into the show and also with our own review of My Neighbour Totoro. When we do that, we'd love to include a special reader mailbag section, so please send in your reactions to the show, if or when you see it, to ghibliotech@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ghibliotech and ghibliotech.pod. That's where you can find information about our ongoing screenings tour in support of the Anime Movie Guide, which, when this episode goes out, should be imminently on shelves in the UK. You can also keep up with us individually on Twitter. Jake is at Jake H. Cunningham, Steph is _Steph Watts, and I am Michael J. Leader.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.